Welcome back. Yes. We got the big brains on again today. And I don't think it's inaugural. What's the closing last podcast from the basement at the Serrano house as him and his family are moving to a new compound, a new farm. But
23 years.
Yeah.
But it's going to be fun. You know, all this, all the new stuff, a new barn with new equipment, bigger
new toys,
gym.
New toys, more space.
Yes. It's gonna. I mean, that way I don't have to have Brian at freaking at 9 in the morning. He can just go to the freaking place and work out, and I don't have to get up.
Yeah, the barns, the barn slash gym slash dog training center
is
attached from his
place.
Yes, it's
going to be awesome.
But we also got the big brain of Dr. Dylan Seeley on as well. Thank you, boys, for joining me. And we're just going to grip and rip just right from all the Instagram questions. There's a bunch, so we'll try and keep it somewhat composed as far as the length of the answers. But obviously, sometimes you never know where any of this is going to go. Kind of a fun first one. What supplements or vitamins to get the most out of your hyperbaric oxygen therapy, HBO2 or HBOT?
Hyperbarics. Yeah. That is a question that is very difficult to answer because it depends what that patient is in the tank for. So you tell me, is it a cancer? You know, what is the situation for that patient being involved? Now, what we do in the office right now, and we started learning about this recently, we're injecting stem cells, we're doing stem cells, and we're doing IV vitamins. Now, we do it because supposedly, with new research coming out, enhances the work of the body, or it makes it work better. Now, most of the time when we have a client, they're coming with severe diseases. And I don't have no specific cocktail for one, you know, for one situation. It depends on the situation. If you're asking, and I'm assuming on this question, what vitamins should you take before you get into that tank? I would say no, not right now, because I want to see how you feel with the hyperbarics. Number one, number two is I do recommend people that come in, and we have patients that I had never seen either. They just ask me after they get into the hyperbarics. I do recommend actually a nasal spray, believe it or not, to unplug your ears. Because sometimes when you go into the tank, your ears feel like they're going to blow up. And the nasal spray, most people know as Afrin. That's what I highly, highly recommend before you get in there. As a vitamin regimen, no, I don't have any for any specific condition.
Yeah, that's interesting just because I'll use the Afrin on people as like they transition into the nasal breathing for workouts or like there is a stimulant in it though.
Yeah,
as well.
Afrin is a stimulant. The only problem is that you can get addicted to Afrin, not psychologically, but physically, because once you spray the Afrin, it causes vasoconstriction on the vessels. That's why you can breathe better. There's no volume in there. But the problem is that some people start using it every day because they feel better. They feel better, and they get actually addicted physically to it because they can't breathe without it. So you do not want to use it. And to be actually, to work optimally, you don't want to use it more than twice a week. And the people that of course, some people come to my office, they got to use it 2, 3, or 4 times. The duration of the spray is about 4 to 6 hours. So.
Yeah, I've been, again, this is just secondhand education, but in the realm where people don't usually know that their nasal passageway constricts and dilates back and forth. So usually you don't have access to both nostrils anyways. And it's so that whatever the membrane inside the nose can rehydrate and recover. So if you stay on this Afrin the entire time, you're going to end up drying and killing the membrane as well.
But absolutely, you lose taste eventually. Actually, I have a cure for that. Then you take a Cialis, and then that goes away. I'm kidding, but it does work. If you use Afrin and use, for some reason, when I dilate that vessels again, go ahead and take a Cialis, 10 milligrams, and it will pull
you up. Well, if we're dealing Cialis, it's just like we'll get everybody a code. Yeah. But also, because I know both of you guys know this as well, how often should you use hyperbarics for TBIs?
Oh, if you have a TBI, there is no method out there. I don't care what you tell me. I don't care drugs. I don't care medication. The best treatment for TBIs is absolutely hyperbarics. You have the research to back it up. I have seen myself the results of it. And I hope that Dylan doesn't mind here. Dylan had multiple TBIs during his career when he was playing. And even after playing, you know, playing rugby, he's coaching and still playing. And Dylan had a lot of TBI symptoms, which involved damage into the brain, body damage, and the hormones don't work. It's pretty severe what TBI can do to you. the vision is affected, all those things. And the only time that I see 100% result, and when I say 100%, I mean something's going to get better. Maybe not everything, but something's going to get better is hyperbarics. Anybody with a TBI involvement have to go to hyperbarics. Actually, Dylan can talk from experience if he wants to.
Yeah, I would say the more the better. You know, look at a lot of the research. It's about 5 to 7 days a week. I think the lowest taper I've ever seen was 3 days a week. Yeah, obviously the more the better. You need a cumulative bout of this to actually make a difference. People do a one-off and they're like, it doesn't do shit. There's actually research that we have that says, oh, we did a one session and this person didn't get any better. Well, it's like, no shit. You're not going to work out one time and then say, I never, you know, lost any weight. It doesn't work like
yeah.
that. You need to put in the effort. You need to have cumulative bouts to see the effects that go on within this.
Most treatment regimens require 30 treatments
yeah.
or 30 sessions.
The lowest yeah. I've seen is 20, or yes. maybe it's 25.
No, but 20. Like, you're right.
But was it because it's the Israeli research, right, where they were doing – because they did all the different atmospheric amounts yes. of pressure where yes. – because now they're going up into the twos in yeah. some of the research.
You have to go to twos, actually. Now, be aware. I want to put a caveat here. People are buying home units
yeah.
for home. And
good,
they
good clarity, yeah.
Well, I want to make sure because they say, oh, I have a home unit. I can do hyperbarics. No, you know, after you're doing any – I'm sorry for the industry out there. You're not doing absolutely nothing. I've never seen the ones that they inflate, the ones that they have at home, they do not work.
No, it's really big in the athletic world. Like a lot of pro athletes have the zip up and some guys will sleep in it and those kind of things. And all it is oxygen condensers.
Yes.
And then some guys will try and get the O2 and like do the nasal inhale yes. and that kind of thing. But it's just
still,
it needs to be sealed off.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is a medical grade hyperbaric chamber. It's glass. It's massive, $70,000-$100,000 unit where like you can't have static electricity. You change your clothes. So
yeah, you're gonna have metal on. I mean, it's a real deal. And you cannot do that in a home yeah. unit.
And then when we're referring to the pressure, like I don't know how to fully describe it as far as atmospheric pressures. It's basically like leagues.
Yeah, like going underwater, basically, yeah. to see to what level, sea level you are. Basically.
Yeah, so
that's what you're doing.
The main research I saw was on 1.5 atmospheres, but I know the Israelis are into the
two.
Easy way to think of atmospheric pressure is when people try to use like altitude mass to simulate pressure.
Yeah.
If you think of it as like tennis balls, so each tennis ball is a thing of oxygen, and so you have 3 tennis balls around you. If I go up into these mountains, the tennis balls are further spread out. So I have to work harder to grab these oxygen molecules. So now my lungs become more efficient. And then I have all these other processes that go on to make me a more efficient breather. As I come back down, the tennis balls become closer. Well, if I go underwater, they pretty much merge into one. And okay. that's a hell of a lot of weight that's pressing into you.
Damn it.
You like that? You're going to seal that now, aren't you?
I'm going to absolutely... I'm going to call that the Dylan theory.
No, I like that a lot.
I like that a lot.
Because I've used a different variant of the analogy for altitude, but I didn't understand. But it makes sense, yeah.
I mean, that is awesome.
Way better than Doc's bus analogies.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything.
Then we got the black people robbing a bus. It just gets really aggressive really fast. Black people being the carbon dioxide yes. that gets the hemoglobin off the...
I mean, that is beautiful. I didn't even seen that on a book, but it's even basic. That is beautiful.
No, that was sexy, Dr. Dill. Next question. We'll just keep it pushing so we can cover some. So, and we've been talking about this already tonight, testosterone replacement therapy for former athletes who have become law enforcement or military in constant high-stress environments, who also train for performance, want to win mentally and physically on and off the job. TRT for ex-athletes or people in high stress, such as law enforcement.
I absolutely highly recommend it. Now, I want to say that the levels of what's normal is changing. They're lowering the levels of what is normal because what we're taking sick people, getting their testosterone levels, and we've seen a trending to get smaller or lower and lower and lower. So, for example, when I started medical school, the lower level was 410 and up. Now it's 200.
Yeah.
So that's crazy what they're doing.
Can we establish what we're calling, like what are healthy levels?
Okay, and I'm going to, but I want to say, well, normal levels right now are 250 to 997 in LabCorp. In Quest is 300 to 1,000. So, okay, that is now. That's what is established as normal values, which for me, that's only a guideline because I've been lucky enough because I did OB and I did all this stuff. I have patients that I follow for 25 years, 30 years. And this person can have a 1,200. And then when they hit 25, now there are 600. Well, the normals were 1,200. So now they don't feel like they used to. So that person is not normal. Now, I use free testosterone much more than only the total testosterone, which, again, it depends on which lab you use. But I'm gonna discuss this specific. I have a lot of policemen, a lot of firefighters, which are dealing with stress. And overnight, they don't sleep, et cetera, et cetera. The stress is the biggest component that is going to affect not only your health, your sex drive. You can tell them the way you're feeling because you don't want to have sex because you're not sleeping or you're highly stressed. Erections fail. Now, not that all the erections are dependent on the testosterone level, but everybody that is, if I were somebody that had authority, I would say, anybody that is a policeman, a fireman, or a fighter, you want to be on testosterone. Why? Because it helps you recover faster. It makes you heal faster. It makes you feel better. It gets you mentally acuity. You just have to do it. Now, for those guys that want to know where will I see your levels, for me, the total testosterone levels don't matter as much as you're free. I want to see your level between 20 and 30. And that's what I want to see your levels.
Boom. Yeah, I think that's fair. So, like, just to, like, play devil's advocate a little bit. Are you robbing Peter to pay Paul with the TRT, or is it a safe option?
No, I don't believe that. You know, the only side effect, if you're doing correctly and physiologically, I'm not talking about taking anabolic steroids like a bodybuilder. I'm talking about to make me feel better, to be physically at my top performance. I'll say you should take it. Now, they are different ways to take testosterone. I want to add that here. There are 10 ways to take testosterone, actually, but people are not aware of that. I don't want to go into that because that doesn't matter right now. We're talking about what to do. If I am a person that have a lot of stress, that's going to affect me all overall. It's going to affect my testicles. It's going to affect my brain. And testosterone levels, and testosterone, actually, TRT protects your brain against damage. Even protects you against TBI. So, yes, you should actually, absolutely, if you could, start taking testosterone legally and on the prescription of a physician.
And then just for more clarity's sake, is that testosterone by itself or is it paired with other things? I know that'll be dependent on blood work to blood work, but
it depends on the blood work because I might need to put you on thyroid. Okay, I have patients that come in and they're taking other things. I don't want to talk about it now, but peptides, they want to be taking something else. So yes, TRT works. Now, if you're highly stressed, one of the most common symptoms, I'm going to talk specifically about males, not females. One of the biggest stressors is, hey, Eric, I'm losing my erections, or I can start, but I cannot finish. I don't get erections in the morning, and they feel normal. And they say, but I'm failing. And I get the levels on the testosterone levels are on the 400s, 500s, which is normal. But for that person, it's not normal. Why? Because the levels might be normal, but not under that condition. I'm highly stressed. I'm getting up. I have to deal with the fire. Those people need my help. I want to have the best of the best serving me, protecting me, saving me. So, yes, I absolutely believe they should use TRT. Well,
I love that. And this one's probably more targeted towards Dill, or maybe just because I've heard the presentation. Proper sequencing and co-contraction drills, both within a training session and in the training periodization.
Hell, I don't even know what that means.
So one more time, proper sequencing of co-contraction drills, both within a training session and in the training periodization.
I'll use co-contractions as a warm-up to get into the big stuff. Okay. Because I'm just trying
Wait, Dylan, explain why they co-
So we have multiple things. People. Yeah, so yeah. We have multiple things. So co-contraction, co-activation. They kind of get a little bit confused here and there. So co-contraction is I have multiple things working around a joint to stabilize. And it's mostly an error detection system. So say if you're coming in with an injury and you got a shoulder injury and we're bench pressing, I might put you into a position where we perform a maximal isometric from like a single arm position and your arm just starts shaking all over the place. That's co-contraction. Right, so co-contraction is having opposing muscles, like antagonists, working around a joint to keep it dead center. Now, what happens is that starts as a, call it a feed-forward loop. So my brain is telling me, okay, I need to contract like this. And what happens is it doesn't work as efficiently as we want. So now we get a feedback loop from the joint. And essentially, it's all the mechanoreceptors in the area saying, we're trying to work here, we're trying to stabilize this. So then it bounces up to the spinal cord, doesn't even have to reach the brain. It comes back down. It does all these things, eventually to where it becomes a feed-forward loop again. It's your body's way of kind of smoothing out a signal and then getting rid of that strategy.
Right. Yeah.
So I'll use that if we're injured to kind of warm up. Like we might use that single arm press against a table or like a modified push-up position to get our shoulder doing what it needs to do or tricep or elbow, whatever it needs to be. Another strategy I'll use is a co-activation. So that's getting synergists to work together. So that might be soleus and hamstring. Like I use a hamstring, that foam roller bridge pretty frequently. And that's to get things to work together that should be working together, but are kind of working out of sequence from each other, right? So that might be a co-activation strategy. So co-activation is when you already have co-contraction nailed down. So it goes co-contraction to then co-activation. And then I just go through my regular workouts as need be. But from a periodizing standpoint, like I just talked about, we'll go co-contraction to co-activation. And then from there, we'll do it on our back. So we'll go supine. From there, I'm going to put a contact reference against the wall because it's going to trick our brain to thinking that we're standing up. So we'll do a co-activation or co-contraction drill from on our back, but our foot's on the wall. So now we have a reference point. We feel like we're standing up, but we're not quite standing up yet. From there, we'll do a plyo against the wall on our back, like a modified plyo. And then now we're starting to recognize speed and everything else from that position. Then I stand you up on your feet, and then we just go back through that same sequence of co-contraction, co-activation, and then co-activation with plyo.
Yeah, so just piecing everything together.
Yeah, so it's just starting it out on our back, because the more reference points your body has, the better. That's the big thing. It's like you can throw someone into a drill that might work really well for somebody else, but if your brain perceives it as a threat, it's going to shut it down. So the easiest way to prevent your brain perceiving it as a threat is just to start out with as many points of contact on the ground. That's why we use a lot of stuff if we're just lying on our back to begin with. A lot of, you know, bullshit rehab drills are done just lying on our back, you know, the first couple of weeks.
I need to dumb this down, man, because yeah. I'm going to be people out there. What did he say?
It's a big brain. He's got a big brain.
But wait, this is awesome. Okay, for people to understand, I want to simplify it. If you're standing up, you're only having contact with the floor with your feet. If you're laying down against the wall, you're having contact with your feet, your back, your butt, and your head. So that is multiple contact points that send a signal to your brain. That's what he calls the co-contraction and the co-activation. That is telling the body, okay, I have multiple setups that I can touch or I can receive information from so I can do what I'm going to do. So, for example, I'm going to simplify what he said. The wall, I'm pushing again. I'm going to put both feet on the wall, right? Instead of one, I'm going to be laying on my back. And now when he was talking like a plyo, then I start touching with my toes. I start doing like a calf raise against the wall. But my back is feeling it. My head is feeling it. And then I do that. And standing up, I might not be able to do it, but they're doing it there. Then I move from there to maybe sitting down, then to standing up. So that is a kind of like a, I would say like a layer of how to do it.
Yeah, I do something similar in the breath world where if they can't breathe right at rest and then faster pace breathing just laying down, they're not going to breathe right in performance or on their feet usually. Yeah.
One thing that you use that I have seen you doing a lot when you're with your clients, and most people don't do what you do. You go to the client and you're touching. Hey, I'm touching you here. I'm touching you here. And initially you cannot tell, but when you start touching that patient, oh, shit, I'm contracting. Oh, yeah, I can feel it. Because touch makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I just call it cueing, but you, yeah. I like your guys' words better.
The points, especially how you coach your breathing. Yeah. So I don't tell people I do a whole lot of it, but I do a lot of pelvic floor for guys because that's kind of an underrated thing.
Yeah,
some guys have it and it becomes a massive issue. And it's not just the fact that, you know, you have pain like when you're going to the bathroom or, you know, you're nervous about something else, or it could be sex related. A lot of that can come down to just breathing. Like we'll fix a lot of that stuff with that. So we'll start out in a happy baby pose. And I just tell them like, you know, I want you to breathe into your asshole. We're just going to try and open this thing up, expand that pelvic floor. And then from there, we put them in a seated position, right? Or no, from there, we'll go quadruped. We'll rock back and then we'll slowly rock forward to change the shape of that pelvic floor to tighten it down. And they still have to breathe into it. And then from there, we'll go seated. And then from there, we'll go standing and then there on the move. So there's always a sequential task because you're just tightening the pelvic floor more and more and more.
Yeah.
With some of that stuff. But yeah, that's kind of a.
That's what I've picked up the opening part of that from you anyways, because I used to just do basically like a variant of dead bug and then nuts to guts concept where like that's more activation as opposed to making sure it's even open to start with, which usually is pretty impeded in most guys that have never touch their pelvic floor before. But just to keep it pushing a little bit, thoughts on hygiene products for those who are trying to get off them, such as deodorants, toothpaste, shampoos, and stuff? Like I'm thinking they're trying to go to more natural options.
Like getting rid of aluminum and all that stuff with deodorants, parabens, and all that.
I'm not a doctor, but I would assume find cleaner products.
There's a website or not a web app, and I see it's called EWG. I might be wrong on it. And in there, you can put like soaps, deodorants, detergents, and it will give you a list. Actually, if I have it on my phone, actually, hold on a second. Let me make sure that that's what it's called, EWG, I think it is the name of it. And it's a cool app because you can put EWG, that's what it's called. And that stands
for EWG.
EWG. And what you do is if you have a deodorant, you put it in there and it gives you like a grading of that. But in there also, if you want deodorants that are natural soaps, it will give you a whole list. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think that's a worthy endeavor in the sense where a buddy of mine, Darren O'Lean, he has a podcast. He was on Down to Earth with Zac Efron, the Netflix stuff. But he has a podcast that I think is really cool. It's called Fatal Conveniences, where you get into these little parts of your life where you don't realize what is impeding you or tainting you, which a lot of times are like the cheaper products, the mainstream products, where like they might smell good or they might taste good or whatever, even the foods, but they're really...
I got a cool case for you. This was maybe 15 years ago. I had a guy that came from Canada, and actually he was a physician that brought me his son. His son was 6 years old with pubic hair. And this guy was a physician, so every possible test that you can do was done for that kid. I was really impressed. I mean, I said, this guy knows more than I do. And I'm looking at this kid. I said, oh, my God, this is a 7-year-old kid, has hair there. How is this possible? And I went through every single question and every CAT, MRI, everything was there. And then I said, okay, I even said, what do you guys do for fun? And the wife said, oh, we do this, and we take 2 or 3 baths a day. I said, oh, how about your son? Does he take? Yeah, we take bath. And then I asked her about what kind of shampoo or soap they do. And so they gave me the name of it. And I told the parents, because they came from Canada, I said, listen, give me 48 hours. I want to think you've done your job. Let me see what I can come up with. And said, I went to Target. I still remember. I turned every single shampoo bottle around in Target. I look like a freak. And I started taking pictures. I still have the pictures. I started taking pictures of every single bottle ingredient. I came home for 4.5 hours. I look at every possible ingredient, compounds, chemicals. And I went back and I said, listen, in your shampoo that you're using, you have these 2 compounds. And I forgot right now, I have it written in the chart. And I said, this causes masculinization in frogs, okay? In frogs. I'm not saying that this is it, that that's what it is, but be aware that this is something that is causing. It's a xenoestrogen, kind of. So the parents, you know, well, we haven't looked at it. Let's see what happens. These parents called me 3 months later. The hair stopped. He was not having beard like anymore. It was incredible by stopping the shampoo that they were using. Actually, the guy started, after I saw him, he started some kind of movement in Canada to be able to say, hey, you can only use this. And actually, Europe only uses 22 chemicals. United States, you can use anything on shampoos or whatever. So be aware that, yes, those ingredients on shampoos or, you know, whatever, soaps can cause issues with your hormones.
Yeah, so. I think that's important just because I think it's massively overlooked.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And then, so this is just probably more towards Doc, but should you cycle off supplements and vitamins for any period of time before your blood draw to avoid interference with like with the test?
That's a double whammy here. No, I wouldn't cycle them. If you need them, don't cycle them because you want to know when you're healthy. Or you also want to know, are these vitamins working? Because a lot of people spend money buying vitamins. Let me tell you a big test that I do, and I haven't talked to you about this. It's called omega-3 index. Omega-3 index look at what is the composition of your cells, cell wall, fat, types of fat, and it gives you omega-6, omega-3, omega-9. And you look at it, and you can tell, okay, is the supplement that I'm taking actually doing what it's supposed to be doing? And if you don't take it when you go do your blood test, then you don't know it's doing it. So you should take it. Don't not take it. And omega-3 index, anybody can order omega-3 index, by the way. It's paid by your insurance. Actually, it's cardioprotective. So if you're having chest pain, you go there, hey, doc, having chest pain, can I do an omega-3 index? Which will tell you where your omega-3 index or your amount of omega-3 is in your red blood. They use red blood cells mostly. I don't know if they use anything else, but red blood cells. And they can tell you, hey, okay, I have so much omega-3 index. and they give you a percent. It should be a percent. It depends on which lab you're using, what that percent is correct. But they will go low, very low, low, normal, or above normal. And it will tell you if you need more or less. I absolutely will not stop my vitamins before I do a blood test because I want to see if they're actually really working or actually I'm taking the real stuff.
Yeah.
So do not do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. It breeds accuracy, I guess. This is also going to be targeted at Doc more racially than anything. But what are y'all's thoughts on consumption of nightshade vegetables? They're very common in the Latino diet. And I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say.
Actually, believe it or not.
Can you explain to my little brain what a nightshade vegetable is?
He said Hispanic specifically. This is interesting.
Latino, yeah. What's a nightshade vegetable?
Wait a second. I'm trying to think. Tomatoes are a nightshade, basically.
I'm Googling. I wish I had it. I need like a Joe Rogan, Jamie Googler.
No, I'm trying to think about Latinos because it's specifically asked.
Tomatoes, peppers, yes, eggplants, but, white potatoes.
But I'm trying to think what, man, Latinos, we don't eat that many potatoes.
They belong to a plant family called the Solanaceae family.
Yeah, but tomatoes is the biggest one.
Yeah, encompasses deadly inedible plants like tobacco, belladonna, and mandrake as well. Thanks, Jamie.
Well, the only thing I can say is, do they make a difference? Yes, I do have. Actually, in some instances, for those listeners out there, tomatoes can cause headaches, and oranges can cause headaches. Actually, if I go through a list of agent causing headaches, oranges and tomatoes are up there. I do not know why. And this is not a nightshade, but broccoli, if you're breastfeeding and you eat tomatoes or you eat broccoli, the baby will be affected. Mm. I see it very commonly with that way. They get reflux, the baby gets reflux. They got the sulfur smelling stool and cramping pain on the baby. So try to stay away from tomatoes and broccoli. Now, in nightshades in Latinos, I was trying to think, where is it coming from? We don't really use, the only thing we can say is pepper or tomatoes that I can think of as being a Latin guy. And I will say this, in some people, I would say 10% of the population, I might see a side effect of this and people will get better. But to acknowledge those people, I do what is called an oxalate level. So, for example, you come in complaining, hey, Eric, I'm having joint pains. I don't everything. I don't know. I get oxalate level. Now, strawberries have high oxalate levels. So don't only know. But at oxalate level, give me a guideline. Spinach are high on oxalate. Kale is high on oxalates. So, you know, all these non-nightshades can be affecting you more than the nightshades. Now, but Hispanics don't eat those that often. But tomatoes is the only one I can think of at the top of my head. Would that affect you? No, I don't think so. Unless you have rheumatoid arthritis, I see them being affected.
Yeah, back when I was trying to solve my ITP.
That is true.
I was.
Tell the people what ITP stands for.
Idiothrombocytopenia, just unexplained low blood platelets. It's something I found as I was trying to get into the NFL. But one of the holistic, I say that in quotations, approaches was to eat a bunch of raw tomatoes, which I hate tomatoes. I experienced the headaches from eating too many tomatoes in that realm. But this is one for both the boys because I know both you guys have used this approach. What are your thoughts on peptides? If you suggest using them, what are the best ones to combine and use individually?
Okay, I don't prescribe peptides because they're not FDA approved, right? So, but people ask me a lot of questions. I gave a couple of lectures on peptides a few years ago, and I know a lot about it because my population, I started to use and experiment with peptides. They're easily accessible, one. Most people tell you, oh, peptides are a new therapy. No, actually, if I tell you guys the number one peptide prescribe is insulin. People have no idea that insulin is a peptide. And peptides work amazingly. Peptides do work. Now, he's asking the three most common ones that I see people using in my office. Again, I do not prescribe them. BPC-157 is used a lot for joint pains injection-wise. Now, the best results that I see from BPC-157 are not from the injection, but it's oral. It makes a massive healing intestinal compound. The reason it comes from the molecule called ghrelin, that is what your stomach releases to induce hunger. So be aware of that. Another one is a classification of different ones, semorelin, tesamorelin, epamorelin, all those increase insulin growth factor 1, so stimulation of the growth of growth hormone. They all work absolutely amazingly. It's combined with the right diet, they induce weight loss, or you get leaner. They allow you to lose local fat. And by the way, people are going to say, no, you cannot lose fat locally. Well, if you start injecting these peptides locally in your belly, you're going to see a decrease on your fat belly, which you're going to say, no way, but it does. I mean, is it a local action? I don't know the answer to that, but you can actually see it. That's one. Now, I don't want to sell anybody. There's something called C-Max, and people are not aware of this. Okay, so C-Max is actually over-the-counter. You can buy that on Amazon, nasal spray. 4 years ago, I had a patient that came in with his child, a 14-year-old kid, that was really depressed, and the kid completely changed. He was doing homework. He was acting normal. He was doing all these great things, and they found C-Max on his book bag, right? And the parents didn't know what it was, and they were concerned. It was, they call it snorting this spray, right? Hmm. So I didn't know what it was, right? I said, I don't know what this is. Let me look into this. And when I figured out, I said, oh, my God, this is a peptide. And it's selling it in Amazon over a nasal spray called C-Max. And I said, this is amazing. When I found out in the literature, it was incredible. Now, I've used C-Max in them to people that have non-responsive to SSRIs or antidepressants. And this C-Max peptide does wonders for those people. Mm. So do I recommend it? No, I don't. I'm just telling you the facts. Now, it comes in a spray. It is injectable. It can be easily mixed and make a spray if you want to. But it's used a lot now. And it's a mental response to this peptide.
Interesting. Yeah, that's one I haven't heard of either. So
yeah, I'm telling you guys right now because I see it so often, but it's for depressant, antidepressant properties, concentration properties. Actually, peptidescience.com, if you look into it, I think they just recently put it in there. And you can look at the scientific literature on it.
Yeah, and I know a decent amount of people that get their peptides from Peptide Sciences as well.
It's legit. So
yeah. It is good stuff. I've seen BPC-157 done intranasal. Had some good success with TBIs with that, Simax as well. A big thing, if you're going to do injectables, I just had a talk with someone today. If you're going to do it, you don't just put the bacteriostatic water and just blast it right into the vial.
By the way, if you're going to, I want to put 5 cc's in the bottle. You cannot put 5, don't try it, it doesn't work. 12 years of experience. Your maximum you can put there is 3 cc's. Don't go above that. You can't. I just want to make sure that they know that.
Little nuance.
Yeah, so yes. Make sure if you're going to do it, you're going to drip it into the side of the vial and just let it run down because those peptides will disintegrate. They are very touchy. I've gotten recently exposed to peptide bioregulators. There's a company out of Russia that's been starting to develop some of this stuff.
I'm aware of it.
And it is some pretty cool shit. I haven't dabbled enough in it to really have an honest opinion on it, but from what I've seen, you can actually target specific structures, whether it be blood vessels, cardiac tissue, pulmonary tissue, brain tissue. I mean, they can really make it hyper-specific, whereas if you just take a BPC, it just hits everything, depending upon your route of administration. If you're going to take it, intranasal, most likely your brain's going to respond to it a lot better. If you're going to take it, orally, your gut's going to respond to it a lot better. If you're doing injectable, like the localized tissue is going to respond to it a lot better. It doesn't mean that it's not going to hit everything, but whatever gets exposed to it first gets exposed like the most to it.
No, I like that a lot because most of the time, I mean, the times that I can say it on here, I'm not getting tested anymore. It was legal when I was doing it, the BPC-157.
MK-677, it was used a lot by the football players.
Yeah, quote-unquote football players.
Well,
yeah.
I'm just saying football players.
Yeah. That's a cool thing, though, with SARMs as well, is that you can stack them on top of these peptides. So, what is it? For Austrian, MK-2866?
But it's crazy that SARMs has such a more negative connotation.
Because we don't really have a lot of the research. But we don't.
That's right. And most of the, I do want to add, some of the SARMs, they have a lot of bad side effects, actually, especially your child. But I want to tell all the children out there less than 19, the SARMs will make you stronger. They work, but the side effects. I have a 16-year-old kid just this week using SARMs. His testosterone was 16. That tells you. And this kid, bro, because the father plays football, brought it in. and he didn't know why. And of course, he was using RAT 40.
Yep.
That's what he was using. And not that they don't work, it's just that you have to be careful. How long you use it, how much you're taking, be aware of that. It will shut you down.
Yeah. I mean, I ran blood labs on a kid when we were in college together. He was taking RAD 40, and I was like, when's the last time you get a blood test? He was like, I never had it done. So he got it done, and his LDL was through the roof looking at some of this stuff. So it's going to have a massive, AST, ALT, all this stuff. So it's going to have a massive effect on your liver as well as, your fat metabolism and everything else. So they're not bad. We just don't know enough about it yet to say, this one's good. You're going to get away with it. Whereas, if you take steroids, we know enough about it to say, okay, you can take this for this amount of time. Then we have to cycle off. But, going back to the peptides and the SARMs, if you stack like an MK2866 with a BPC-157, like that has tremendous healing properties. So when, because with the MK2866, we actually have research within rats, like it regrows bone. Right. So it regrows the bone. So if you have a fracture or something else and then you mix that with the BPC-157, like it's phenomenal in speeding up a healing process. Doesn't mean it doesn't come without risks, but it's big risk, big reward.
I also want to say something on SARMs. SARMs are sometimes drugs rejected by the pharmaceutical industry. Just remember that.
Say that one more time.
SARMs sometimes are drugs rejected by the pharmaceutical company.
Interesting. Yeah, I got you.
Got it? Okay. Yeah,
there wasn't big enough margin on it.
Yes. Yeah. Or, I don't know.
This one's from Ebner. So we've talked to a bunch of the Q&As, me and Doc have touched on this as well. But we'll just rehash it real quick. We'll keep these quick. But overall thoughts on cholesterol, total versus HDL and LDL individually, threat of high cholesterol, and how to eat high fat while not driving those numbers even higher.
Okay, Nate, cholesterol is not what the people or what physicians are telling you. 50% of all the hormones are made out of cholesterol, testosterone, estrogen, cortisol. 100% of vitamin D is made out of cholesterol. 53% of your brain is cholesterol. 80 to 90% of your bile is made out of cholesterol molecules. The body has two ways to make cholesterol. One is the statin, how they CoA reductase. That's how they affect it. So I want to tell people, as a physician, we started with cholesterol. It was the bad cholesterol was bad. Then when we reduced your cholesterol and we didn't see the changes we wanted to see, then we went to the HDL. So if your HDL is low, it's bad for you. Then we didn't get the results we wanted. Then we went to LDLs. Oh, the LDLs are the bad. If HDL is low, but LDL is low, you're okay. Well, we figured out that was not true. Now, if you go to a physician that knows what they're doing, it's not even the cholesterol you need to worry about it. It's two molecules. It's called the ApoB protein and the little lipoprotein A. So remember, ApoB, big, large B, for bad, and little lipoprotein A, so bad, the word bad, okay? Now we're saying, oh, no, it wasn't cholesterol. It wasn't none of those. It was these two proteins, all right? And if you look at a cholesterol molecule, and I'm going to send you a slide so you can show it to the people. You look at chylomicrons. When you eat and you absorb these fats, they're called chylomicrons. That's what goes into your limbs. So look how God is, G-O-D, no M-D. God gave you a highway just for fats. So that tells you that you need to eat fats. I want to repeat what I'm going to say. There's a highway in your body just for fats. It's called lymphs. All it carries is fat, your white blood cells, your immune system. Your immune system is dependent on fat. Yes, there's cholesterol in there. There's a lot of fat in there because it's necessary to take those fat to where they're needed. Is cholesterol bad for you? Absolutely not. The longer living people on the world always have large amounts of cholesterol. So cholesterol is a money-making molecule. It's not a health-making molecule. Okay? We can give you a pill and we say, oh, you're fine. Cholesterol does, statins do not decrease any of the heart attacks or anything like that. The new ones, the PCSK9s, they reactivate or make the activation of platelets more abundant. So be aware of that. So if you have a high cholesterol, the question is, why do I have high cholesterol? Is it because I don't make enough testosterone? Is it because I don't have enough vitamin D? Is it because my body is affected? My digestive system is affected. My body's making cholesterol because I need to make something with it. Now, I want you to listen to this. Your body makes 80% of all the cholesterol in your blood. But if I start feeding eggs, by the way, when I was competing on powerlifting, I would have 12 eggs in the morning, 12 eggs at lunch, and 12 eggs in the afternoon, right?
Disgusting.
Because I know, but I wanted to keep my weight. You know, I couldn't eat junk, so I had to eat that. My cholesterol, eating, 36 eggs a day. By the way, I have to do life insurance. I don't want my butt, I don't want to be poked at all, but I have to have life insurance. My cholesterol was 176, eating 36 eggs a day. So that tells you my body didn't want to make cholesterol because I was giving them cholesterol. So if you want to lower your cholesterol, eat fat. You will not make cholesterol, and then you start using that cholesterol to what you need.
Yeah, I think that was, we'll call that beautiful.
Okay.
So kind of in the same realm of like longevity, but also in the same realm of diet, and I always butcher this word, but is deuterium a concern with nutrition regarding mitochondrial health long term? If so, should we be in a low carb state for most of the time? Many high deuterium foods such as carbs may cause mitochondrial dysfunction.
Shit, whoever asked that question is a PhD. There's no way. That was a very, not only was a straight question.
Definitely a doctor. Yeah, that's Dr. Mata, yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, no way.
Yeah.
That was too specific. Okay, let me, Dylan, can I take this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's talking.
You want me to take a crack at it?
Okay, deuterium is a high level of hydrogen. I'm going to use Dylan's analogy. I'm going to have a bunch of hydrogen. So the more hydrogen accumulation you have, the more damaging it is for your body. That's what is told or said, which is partially true. So the mitochondria produces H, hydrogen, but also produces oxygen. So we actually make water on the conversion of energy. So and Dylan is the expert on this.
Dylan's whiteboard on the Krebs cycle. Sexy.
Yes, so yeah. I know he's the expert on this, but I'm just saying that. So for those people out there, deuterium is actually considered a high level of hydrogen or gas of hydrogen. Now, in the research shows that when you have high deuterium or hydrogens, you actually have a higher tendency to get cancer and things like that. When you have carbohydrates, and who is it? Dr. Mata?
Dr. Mata, yeah.
I would love to see what he does for a living. Can carbohydrates do this? Yes and no. Because when you break down carbohydrates, this is a tough question here. Let me think of how I'm going to answer this. High carbohydrate diets are damaging? Yes. It has been proven, and I agree with you. Yes, it can be more damaging. Now, I'm going to base it on research because I never want to present something to the listeners that is not research-based. Can high-fat diets, or let me be more specific than that, can low-carbohydrate diets be beneficial for or preventing this? I absolutely agree, but not because this specific situation is because what he's saying about the Warburg's phenomenon on cancer. We know that when we eat carbohydrates, we induce acceleration of cancer, okay? For example, and this is I want the listeners to understand this. If I have cancer and I want to know where it is, I do a PET scan. And a PET scan is a highly specific, amazing test. It can look at your organism and see how it's working. So they inject you with a solution, and the highest metabolic activity is by cancer cells because they want to suck it all in and use energy to keep reproducing nonstop. That's a high level of hydrogen. Got it? So that's how we know. But the interesting thing is when we inject these patients to mark the cancer, guess what we inject? Glucose. Mm. Glucose that lights up. So that's kind of interesting that we're injecting you with sugar that is marked to glow, right? And then we'd say, oh, yeah, you have cancer because they accumulated on this organ, so the organ. So, Dr. Mata, I will say, yes, you're correct. I do not know or I'm not familiar with any research from the top of my head that have looked at this specifically, but I totally agree with you.
Yeah, and then obviously, so I think part of the question is him also making the case for not eating carbohydrates all day and just keeping them to smaller windows.
I would say that is true.
I'm assuming, but yeah.
Well, yeah, you need some carbohydrate to burn fat.
Yeah, guaranteed.
So yes, you need some carbohydrates. Now, the body is born insulin resistant. People are not aware of this. The reason we're born insulin resistant is because if we eat, okay, let me go back. People think that we need insulin to absorb sugar. False. That's not true at all. Two organs in your body, well, three organs really. We need insulin on the fats and the muscles. They do require insulin to absorb it. The brain doesn't require insulin, but it makes it work better. There are areas in your brain that do not, you don't have mitochondria because it's too thin. Now, be aware that if we're born insulin resistant, it's because it want to protect our brain, and we don't need sugars all the time or carbohydrates. But we require them sometimes because we're hunting, we cannot find food. Or the soil, and we find this food, we eat as much as we can. We want to have high levels of insulin so we can absorb it. So that is the premier for that.
Nice. This is for both of the boys. At what point did you realize you were going to be a doctor in your respective fields? Was there a turning point or a switch that went off that immediately made you realize that this is what you want to do for a living?
I always wanted to be a doctor. Now, not this doctor. I wanted to be a vet all my life. Damn it. Actually, I went to school at Kansas State because I wanted to be a vet. And they have one of the best vet schools in the nation. And by the way, I got to put a hint here. Rebecca, my daughter, is a vet now, so it's kind of cool. I wanted to be a vet all my life. And then when I started playing sports there and doing sports, I said, well, I like sports medicine a little bit. I started my master's in exercise physiology, but I still was working at the vet school. And all of a sudden I said, well, let me go to the vet school. Let me go work there. But then I got interested in such interest on human performance that I went the other route. But I always wanted to be a doctor.
Nice.
No, I would say it's the exact opposite. I didn't give a shit about being a doctor. Still don't. So I worked for Justin Kavanaugh. I only wanted to stay there and work. All I wanted to do is train athletes all day long. And his thing was, I won't hire you back until you become a doctor or something. So then at that point, I'm going into my senior year of college and I have no idea what I want to do. So I'm looking up all these doctoral programs. I'm looking at, I remember the two that stuck out was I can go be a physical therapist, cause Shenandoah University had a branch right next to Cavs gym. Or I could go down exercise science route. I had a big interest in muscle physiology. Boston University has a really good muscle physiology lab. So those were the two that I was, you know, really harping on. So I didn't realize this at the time, but when you apply to a physical therapy school, you apply to an agency. And then the agency then sends your transcripts off to the university. Well, due to all the middleman bullshit, my transcripts didn't get there in time. So now I'm kind of screwed because I can't even be, you know, my stuff can't even get looked at for acceptance into the program. So now I really have no idea what to do. So I'm going, I had a rugby tournament that weekend when I found out all this news. And my coach at the time says, hey, just talk to this chiropractor. They actually give you rugby scholarships to go play for this school. I said, no shit. So I talked to the guy. He said, okay, let me set you up with a visit. Went out there. They offered me on the spot. I was like, all right, perfect. I know where I'm going to be. Didn't know shit about chiropractic. Never been to a chiropractor in my life. I went 2 weeks before school because I got my jaw knocked out of place. And I was like, let me see if these guys are full of shit or not.
TBI.
Yeah. So, TBI number 7.
Yeah. So I went and got worked on. I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then that's how I ended up actually in chiropractic school. The only reason I went was just to play sports.
Pretty
cool.
Great story. In retrospect now, are you happy with the choice?
Yeah, I would say it's not bad. It's got its days.
Well, I mean, but that's the cool thing. Well, like as an ex-athlete and doing all that thing, you start to find the people that, regardless of their title, general practitioner, mm-hmm. chiropractor, whatever it ends up being, you find the learners, you find people that have generated some type of leverage on their knowledge to, again, add to the industry, add to the athletes in front of them, all those kind of things. So you know, and like obviously why I love both of you guys in that realm, that you've never stopped learning, you earned everything you got. But you also continue to learn and apply and trial and error. And
absolutely. I was disappointed with, I know people are going to think I'm crazy. I was disappointed for being a medical doctor because in the hospital, I was a champion. I was the director of ICU, right? But as soon as the patient walked out of the hospital, I was not good at all. I was saving life in the hospital. I mean, the hospital was amazing. I was able to do whatever I wanted because I'm in the ICU. I intubated you. I give you drugs. I keep you alive. I maintain your life, but as soon as you step out of the hospital, I was weak. I was not making my patients better, and that's when the light bulb went off. I said, oh, my God, I can make a difference. I got to make changes.
Well, that's where, like, and I had this conversation earlier today because I went to a whole different kind of doctor this morning, energy healer, et cetera, the whole different naturopathic approach that I just wanted to try out and in general and network with and that kind of thing. But it's also you learn like how much of the system is built for true healing, whether it, then now we get into like pain relief and relief in general, as opposed to the right knowledge and the light leverage and the right work and suffering that needs to go in to become a healthy human. And I think that's where you guys embodied that fully. Yeah. But
naturopathic doctor always, I have a lot of patients that see naturopathic doctors, and I work with a lot of naturopathic doctors. I call them, we call, you know, I have the, I'm lucky enough that I have the best of best words, because I can, hey, yes, you can use this. No, you cannot use this. But I think naturopathic doctors are amazing. I mean, if you have a good one, man, stick with them because they're very, very good.
Yeah, I guess. So I have a question now just from, so I had an interesting naturopathic experience where like the lady actually was awesome. I was just in a really bad place. Just prefacing this. I had just gotten to Hawaii. I was sick and I was about to do that 50-mile ruck. And so I was on the phone for an hour and a half to try and find somebody to get an IV and get ozone therapy to try and wipe this out before I have to ruck through the night, because I know that's not going to help.
I got the call.
So obviously Doc was part of my counsel in here. So I found one, and it happened to be a recommendation from one of Laura's friends out in Hawaii. So we get there, and like there's this whole menu of stuff, and like it's pretty pricey. And from so like this is just my small brain, very closed off. Also, very sympathetic state. And so like I very cleanly said, like I want the Myers cocktail plus this, and I want ozone. Like I don't need this whole other recipe. And so anyways, I get the ozone, and then between the ozone and what I thought was just going to be an IV, she starts hooking me up to
ultraviolet light.
It's not ultraviolet light. It was electric. So it was like reading my
bioimpedance.
All my levels as far as like vitamin B deficiencies. I can't remember, like, because I looked into the machine after. Yes. I couldn't find the specific machine.
It's a Omega.
No, it's not Omega. It like literally.
But there's a machine that does what you're talking. What is it called?
The AO.
Yes, like AO.
Yeah.
Like an AO. Absolutely.
But so, and then she was going through parts of my hand to identify what organs were dysfunctioning and stuff like that. It was just a part of the thing that. Again, I said I didn't want. So anyways, she goes through that. I was like, are you just doing this to like identify what goes in my supplement IV? She goes, yeah. And she goes, then do you want recommendations on supplements? I go, like, I think I'm pretty good. I got my blood work done not too long ago. And then she goes, she was just recommendations and recommends me like 8 different products. And I go, oh, sweet. Because like apparently I had parasites. I can't remember the whole long. There's a laundry list. But anyways, I go get my IV. They leave me in there too long. Besides the point, this is me defending myself. And then I get out of there, and they charge me for the long list that I said I didn't want. And but then this is like friends of friends of Laura, so it wasn't a great scenario. But besides the point, the practical application, the approach that like as this naturopath as a whole was really cool. Love the IV therapy, the menu they had. The acupuncture techniques they were using. She did a lot of work on Laura that was dynamite. The supplements have worked awesome for her. But like I like the approach where it's like none of what she gave out, most of it was natural, obviously naturopath, natural versions of medicine, different roots and all these other things. And then also things like I've never even thought about parasites in that realm, where I just thought it was like a cool approach. But anyways, I ended up getting in an argument with this awesome person. This is my public apology, but I was clearly stating the fact that I said what I wanted, and I didn't know that this extra step in between the IV ended up being a $500 step. So anyways, besides the point, bad story for the podcast, but I don't think I'm allowed back at naturopaths in Hawaii is the moral of the story, but that's about it. But then, Dil, did you have any questions? I knew you floated the questions out on the podcast too.
Yeah, one of the first ones I got was programming in consideration for rugby. Like, how would you stack lifting and running? But a lot of it just depends on where we're at within the season. Obviously, rugby is a little bit of a different beast because you're playing, for the most part, year-round. If you're playing sevens and 15s or league or whatever it might be, you're just bouncing in between different codes.
More manly than NFL, by the way.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm a big rugby fan.
The only guy that we have to have here is Nate, because he had done both.
And he'll tell you, like, like head and shoulders above as far as toughness goes, like his Olympic camp and like even just transitioning out of the energy systems into Olympic camp, even like their training camp and stuff, or like the warm-ups for that, what just baptized him in fire. It was crazy. And that's one of the people that like train with him for 5 years, and I've never seen anybody work harder to have him go and just be buried and like questioning his soul. It, like, I think is enough testament.
It's cool. But I would say I've been exposed to so many different systems. So we've used like maximal aerobic speed, which is just covering like a certain distance within a certain amount of time. So you would go run like a mile and a half test or mile or 2 mile or whatever it be. And then you would take that, you know, your distance divided. You would essentially, you get 12 minutes or whatever you want to use for your time sake. You get 12 minutes, you got to run as many, you know, many meters as possible. And then from there, you can divide it out and see how many meters per second are you moving. And then from there, you can then build out a program. But the thing is, that beats the living shit out of you because you are going pretty high effort. You're about 3/4 speed the entire time. There's no, you're not really taking a lull. So it's fantastic if you need to get in shape very quickly, but it beats you up. So I'm big on, say, if we're starting out and it's, you know, early preseason camp, I'm 6 weeks out. Like I might just use a lot of like zone two work, and then we'll use small sided games. So essentially like just making the field bigger, smaller, you know, changing around different drills to then hit our cardio requirements. So not only are we getting our skill work done, so now we're becoming more efficient at our sport. So I'm using less cardio, but then I can also supplement using cardio outside of that. Cause that's the tricky thing that you get into. You got guys who have very big IQ, or women who have very good IQ for what they're doing in their sport. So they expend a lot less energy. Right. If you've ever, you know, gone against someone who knows what they're doing, they beat the shit out of you. Right. You've ever rolled with Vitor, he'll laugh at you and smack you around the face while I'm squirming the absolute hardest to get out from underneath of him.
Yeah.
All right.
Mastery special.
Right. So, same thing. So you have to find a workaround with them. So then that's when I would add in the extra conditioning, not extra conditioning work, but we'd have days set aside to where we would be doing, you know, speed work or, you know, other distance work, other things. Cause I mean, you talk to any rugby player, they've ran Malcolms or they've ran coat hangers. Those are usually the two most popular things that you do. Malcolms are just, you know, 10 meters up, down, back, 10 meters up, down, and all that bullshit. Coat hangers are where you start on the 50 and you run through one goalpost, come out, run, you know, 100 meters the other way, cut through the other goalpost, then you end up back where you started to look like a coat hanger. So those ones are probably the two most popular methods that people like to use. But I've kind of mixed it up on feet, off feet, depending upon, you know, how big the athlete was, you know, where, if you're a prop or if you're a winger, how much distance do we need to cover? So I'll use a mix of small sided games and some of that stuff. As we get closer, we'll peel back a lot of that, you know, high intensity efforts, cause I'm not trying to gas you out going into season. So from there, you know, we're still lifting. We might lift 3-4 days a week. As we get into season, we lift, you know, 2-3 days a week max. I might have a heavy upper on, Monday, you know, heavy lower on Tuesday, and then a speed lift on Thursday.
That depends where games are.
Yeah. Well, we're playing on Saturdays. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So rugby is usually played on Saturdays. We don't have to worry about any of the bullshit on that. And then from there, you're going to touch upon your speed work once a week. Usually I'm going to stack it up on my heavy lower day. And the reason is because I want all my high stressors consolidated at one time, right? Most people say, it's dumb to, use your speed work on a day where your legs are already fatigued. But the last thing I want to do is take something that's neurally intensive on a Tuesday and then run it again neurally intensive on a Wednesday. It just makes no sense for me, right? So that's how I would look at that. And then, you know, from there, we might touch upon certain things like my, you know, lactate work, my lactic glycolytic work, you know, it tapers, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to build up, and then it's got a 2-week residual. So we'll probably hit it every 3 or 4 weeks, depending upon who we're playing. So I would time up when I was handling stuff for Palmer, I would time up things by who we were playing. If we were playing someone that sucked that weekend, I knew we could push a little bit harder in conditioning because we weren't going to expend as much energy during the game, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So then you can start timing things up like that.
I like that.
I don't know if you got
what's I can't remember what Nate called it. Is it the Yaka Yard?
Yeah, the Yaka Yard. Mike Friday's big on those.
What is that?
It's just absolute torture. You know, it's a mix of just like going back and forth, you know, hitting ruck shields, making tackles, up downs. I mean, you name it. It's just continuous and you're going from one thing to the other. Our coach, he would call it like churning butter. So essentially, like his big thing was, you would start, like, and there's 6 shields lined up. You would go, you would hit one, you'd backpedal, hit the deck, come back up, up, down, hit, you know, hit the pad, come back. And you would do that. You'd go through all 6 pads. And then from there, you would run through a line of people holding shields that are just trying to put you on your ass. And then from there, you're taking off, you know, running 20 meters out, coming back, sticking a couple of tackles, hitting a couple of rucks, getting pulled off, and then you're done on the cycle. And then you go back through in another like minute. Yeah.
Duck's face.
Yeah, yeah. We used to do those all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just a different level of conditioning. It's similar to if anyone's ever wrestled. It's like tapping into that type of thing.
That type of dark place.
Yeah. It's like you just got to dig deep and go through the bullshit. Because anyone who's ever, especially who's playing sevens, like when Nate played sevens for that, it's all out. There is no stopping. Because if you stop, you get exposed. You just have to keep going and going and going.
Yeah, that's bananas. All right, just two quick questions to close it out. Best test to assess gut health and favorite dietary strategies or probiotics to improve overall dysfunction. We've talked about this on one of the Q&As before, but if we just want
to... Best test to get health on your gut history. You need to talk to the patient. Ask the right questions. I don't care. There's no test that is better than your history. Okay, why? Because when I eat dairy, I get sick. Well, that's telling me right there. So don't ever go out and say, I want your best test to get the best results. No, it's your history. You need to sit down there and ask the questions. Remember, I know that sounds easy, but you have to ask the right questions. Stool is about testing for stool. The stool analysis is from the last part of your colon. It is not your whole intestines. It's only the lower third of your colons. So the stool analysis just give you ideas. Now, people don't understand how they do stool analysis. Stool analysis, I've done this, so I want you to understand the basics of it. I take a piece of poop, I blend it, and then instead of looking at the bacteria, I look at the number of DNA fragments or RNA fragments in that particular stool. So they're not looking at the bacteria. They're looking, oh yeah, there's this number of pieces of DNA, RNA, or there's a high number of them. There's a probability that that's what it is in there. So we don't even know exactly which bacteria is in there. We assume by looking at the DNA, RNA. Now, again, it's the lower third component of your colon. That doesn't tell you what's in your intestine, what's in your stomach, because there are different pHs, different living organisms, parasites, whatever. Three, I want to say this, and I know people are going to think I'm crazy. I took the same patient, poop in the morning, poop in the afternoon, and I said, I want to send both. And I sent it to the same lab. They were totally different, even though it was the same human being, right? I have a friend of mine that he's a physician, actually, and he's a little off out there of the head. He sent a human and a dog poop, actually. And, of course, here come the results, right? Yeah. So
the dog poop was healthier.
Well, no. I mean, they give you, but it was a dog. Which he told me, Eric, look at this. They're saying that he has this. So be aware of those tests. Not that they're guidelines, but this not the end all. Probiotics for me are the last resort of treatment. And let me explain this. If I have issues with my gut, I need to remove what is causing the problem. That's the number one rule. Remove what is causing. It's a eating. It's a stress. It's a your wife. I mean, it can be a stressful.
She's stabbing you in the stomach.
Yeah, I mean, she can stress the shit out of you, and you're going to get sick. You need to, don't eliminate your wife, but you need to keep the distance with your wife, right? Be aware of that. Once I remove that, then I need to repair that gut. So if I introduce bacteria to a house that has holes on it, that bacteria is going to come in anyway. I don't want that bacteria coming into my house. I want to keep it away. So I want to repair that hole in the wall that consists of glutamine, might consist of fish oils, whatever I need to repair. Then I do not still not introduce. What I do, I add stuff to help me digest the food. Might be pancreatic enzyme, might be HCL, whatever, you know. And that's how I do things. My last resort is introducing bacteria or fungals. By the way, the number one organism in your intestine is not bacteria, it's viruses, or they're called phages, phages. Okay, so be aware of that, that is very important. So again, the number one test is history. Sit down, talk, write it down. I ate this, I got sick that day, I had a fire, had coffee, pizza, or I had a game and I played my worst and that's when I got sick.
Yeah, it's not just what you put in your mouth is what is going to influence digestion.
Yes,
same as breathing and things along those lines. Last question. Thoughts on Corella supplements like the...
Wuji Corella.
What's up?
Like a Wuji Corella type thing.
Sorry, like my headphones.
Like the green supplement.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, it's an algae, I believe. Yeah,
it's, like it's a great supplement. It's a great supplement. Now, be aware that
like the athletic greens and all those kind of deals. Yeah,
it's a great supplement, but be careful because now Chinese supplements are coming out of cholera, and they're not good at all, and actually they're contaminated with lead. I know this because I have two microbiologists in my office that do analysis of what they have a cholera company, and damn it, I should have their company, but I forgot. In which they analyze a lot of the cholera. Cholera bind toxins is excellent. I mean, yes, it's a supplement that are.
But you got to be careful of the source.
Exactly. Source, absolutely, yes.
Have you either you guys looked into the AG1, the Athletic Greens, if that's like a decent source?
No, I have not. But have you, Dylan?
I haven't used it.
I see it everywhere, and some people swear by it, and X, Y, and Z. But it's a lot of benefits that they say are wrapped into like one source, and there's so many ingredients where I worry that it's not as
there's no such that supplement doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean it was
maybe God, faith, but no.
Well, I mean like it's also they're putting a bunch of different forms of all the other micronutrients and vitamins in there anyway, so it's just like I mean
remember it's a supplement, food first supplement.
Yeah.
So you can have that supplement but you don't eat correctly.
But I still stand behind like having like a very complete multivitamin to defend against deficiencies.
And that might
suffice. I'll go through and see if what the active ingredients are and what's trash in there. But
let me know.
But boys, always, it's an absolute pleasure.
That was good. That was good.
All right, RIP to the basement. But thank you, everybody. Be well.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for tuning into the podcast. Hope you're getting a lot out of it, a lot of value. Or at least some entertainment. But if you are enjoying and getting value out, please don't hesitate to like, subscribe, and review on all audio platforms, and then subscribe on YouTube. All of it would be greatly appreciated. All the support is massive. So thank you and be well.